So I'm going to give this, this is one of the overview talks, and the hope is that these talks would provide a basis for discussion in the afternoon session today, in the late afternoon session today. So we know, as we saw this morning, the three talks this morning, that in general relativity, the gravitational field is coded in the very geometry of space-time, and this immediately says that the space-time itself ends at singularities. And the general expectation, however, is that the theory is, this prediction comes from a theory where it is being pushed beyond the domain of its applicability, and to really know what is going on, we must incorporate quantum physics. And so in this sense, I think that singularities are really our gateways to physics beyond Einstein. But if you try to do a straightforward incorporation of quantum physics into general relativity following the grand avenue that was laid out by Peter Bergman, Paul Dirac, John Wheeler, Charlie Misner, Bryce DeWitt, and others, which is generally called the Wheeler-DeWitt theory. So if you use that in quantum cosmology, then one finds that contrary to the initial expectation that particularly John Wheeler had, that the singularities are generically not resolved. So just bringing in quantum physics is not enough. But it turns out that the situation is very different in loop quantum gravity. And here, physics does not stop at the singularities. And quantum geometry extends its life. And resolution of space-like singularities that we heard about this morning in great detail has been analyzed at three levels. The first level was pioneered by Martin Boyewald. And what one finds here, or what Martin found, and then other people, that the quantum Hamiltonian constraint does not break down. And this is now been extended also to more cosmological models. Martin was considering just the Friedman, Roberts, and Walker. And it has also been considered, also been looked at for the black hole interior models and some mini-superspaces. But it turned out that in the initial work that was done, part of my, most of my lecture is going to be more logical, but I want to give you some historical perspective because there are people who are not completely in the field are often confused because one can see some statements in a paper which is 2002 and an almost opposite statement in the paper which is 2004, and so what is going on, why is this happening, etc. So initially, the way that the singularity resolution was done in Martin's analysis, he implicitly assumed that the connection, the gravitational connection, which in this case is the same as the trace of the extensor curvature. In the homogeneous isotropic case, we only have one component of the extensor curvature, and that is just a trace. That, the trace of the extensor curvature, he assumed that was actually periodic. And then in a workshop in the Schrödinger Institute, I think it was 2004, there was a lot of discussion, and particularly Bill Andrew and others pointed out that, well, this is completely an artificial assumption. Why do you assume this? And you are getting all kinds of quantization, etc., just using this assumption. At that workshop, also, Klaus Friedenhagen, who is an algebraic quantum field theorist, provided us a lot of intuition, and then Martin and Jurek and I were able to remove this assumption, and one could actually do quantum cosmology without assuming that the extensor curvature is on a circle, it's really on the real line, it can take any real values whatsoever. And that created, so to say, a mathematical framework, at least for kinematics, that has been used since. But still in 2004, the mathematical, this problem was removed, but nonetheless, we had a Hamiltonian constraint, and all one could see is that the Hamiltonian constraint does not break down. But then, again, many more general models were considered using this paradigm. But then again, people quite rightly, particularly, for example, Brunemann and Thiemann, raised the issue about, okay, Hamiltonian constraint doesn't break down, but in what sense is the singularity resolved? I mean, what is happening? What is the physics there, etc.? And one could not answer this question of the physics of the Planck regime, because one did not have a physical Hilbert space. or the Dirac observables, or a notion of an emergent time that could be used to interpret physics, to interpret the quantum dynamics. So the second step was only in 2006 that a physical Hilbert space and Dirac observables and also an emergent time was introduced for first Friedman-Robertson-Walker models and then more general homogeneous models. And then the third step was that there was a Hamiltonian constraint obtained here, but that Hamiltonian constraint had certain problems, and this was realized only because one had constructed the physical Hilbert space, Dirac observables, and one could actually extract physics. Only after that, one realized that this Hamiltonian constraint had serious problems. So this was, so to say, step number two here already. And that problem was resolved, and we'll come to this in some detail later on. And now, one has a physical Hilbert space, and also one can solve the Hamiltonian constraint using effective equations or exact numerical solutions, and also in some exactly soluble models, one can solve them and one can get in very detailed physics. And these important questions raised by Brunemann and Thiemann, and I also come to this, Green and Nelson, they have been actually answered now. So the goal here is to present an overview and discuss the conceptual issues, emphasizing subtleties and clarifying the overall situation to set the stage for discussion. And as I already mentioned, this can be confusing because as the subject evolved, we learn from our mistakes. And I will present the final picture rather than, you know, step by step. I outlined to you the steps just now. I'm not going to go through step by step. I'm just going to present to you the final picture. The three tools have been used. One is numerical evolution in exact loop quantum cosmology. The second tool is effective equations. And a lot of talks tomorrow will be devoted to effective equations. And the third is exact analytical results in the k equal to 0 and lambda equal to 0 models. These three avenues reinforce each other, and we have got a lot of intuition about what is happening in detail in the Planck regime around the Big Bang. So the talk is going to be divided into two parts. The first is going to be a summary. I mean, this was really hard a little bit to prepare because half the people know all this subject very well and have heard these talks 100 times maybe, and the other half people don't know. So therefore, I'm going to make a quick summary of this and then enter into more detailed questions, which are frequently asked questions and conceptual clarification. So this is the first sweep, so to say, in which I present a broad overview, and then we go to some technical issues here. Please stop me anytime you want, because here there's a whole bunch of questions that I've listed. If I don't go through the list, that's perfectly fine. If I just go through some of those questions, that'll be fine. We can discuss others in the discussion period. Okay. So the simplest model would be the k equal to 0 Friedman-Robertson-Walker model, and also the cosmological constant equal to 0. So in this case, I'm plotting here volume versus phi. So what we're doing is, we're just fixing in space some elementary cell. And that is fixed once and for all. The metric changes, and as the metric changes, the volume of that elementary change cell is going to change. And that is what I'm plotting up here. And over here, this is a model where there is a massless scalar field. So I'm plotting a massless scalar field up here. And we've got two kinds of solutions. The universe can begin at the Big Bang with an explosion and expand out. Or there is a time reverse branch in which the universe begins with infinite volume and contracts and ends its life in a big crunch. And of course, you are either on this branch or on this branch. And our observations show that currently we are on this branch. So the question that one can ask in quantum physics is the following. Supposing I take a point on this branch somewhere here, and I construct a semi-classical state in quantum theory. I'm assuming we have a well-defined quantum theory, a physical Hilbert space, Dirac observables and all that. So using that, I can construct a semi-classical state which is peaked at this point in this V phi space, in this sort of the relevant part of the phase space. And I take this semi-classical state and I evolve it forward in time and backward in time. And then one would like to know what happens. Well, in the older Wheeler-DeWitt picture, if I evolved it forward in time, the state remained peaked along this classical trajectory. So there is no problem with agreement with general relativity. So to say, the infrared behavior is perfectly fine. But as you evolve the thing backward in time, then the state also follows the classical trajectory and goes into the singularity, and therefore the singularity is not resolved. In loop quantum cosmology, the current version that we have is that the situation is different. Again, you take a state which is, this is plotting the expectation values and dispersions of this volume at any given value of the scalar field. And so we can again take a semi-classical state and evolve. Again, if you evolve it forward in time, it remains peaked. And in fact, the evolution is very similar to that of the Wheeler-Levitic wave. However, if you evolve it backward in time, it remains peaked until the density of matter is about 1% of Planck density. And then, however, something dramatic happens. Instead of following the wave packet, instead of following the trajectory into the Big Bang singularity, actually it bounces and joins on to a branch, another branch, which at late times follows a classical solution up here. So the overall picture would be that you have got a contracting pre-Big Bang branch, which is joined on in a deterministic fashion to the post-Big Bang branch that we have. This morning we heard about ekpyrotic scenarios, cyclic models, also the peak Big Bang scenarios of string theory. The problem there is that we do not have a deterministic evolution from the branch which is a pre-Big Bang with a post-Big Bang. One makes heuristics or sometimes invokes some additional principles in order to tell you how these are joined, but there is no fundamental theory so far which tells us how these two branches are joined in string-inspired pre-Big Bang theories or cyclic models or ekpyrotic models. Whereas here, the important thing is that, in fact, the quantum evolution is deterministic. So the k equal to 0 results are the following. We assume that the quantum state is semi-classical at late time and evolved forward and backward in time. The state remains semi-classical until very early and very late times, until about the matter density is 1% of the Planck density, or the scalar curvature is about 1 upon Planck length squared. And therefore, we know from first principles that space-time can be taken to be classical, for example, during the inflationary era. At the onset of inflation, the matter density is about 10 to the minus 12 rho Planck, and until it is about 1% of Planck density, general relativity is an excellent approximation. In the deep Planck regime, however, semi-classicality fails, but the quantum evolution is well-defined through the Planck regime and remains deterministic, unlike in other approaches, and you don't need any new principle in order to join the pre-Big Bang branch to the post-Big Bang branch, or we don't need any boundary condition, such as the Hartle-Hawking boundary condition. Quantum Einstein's equations by themselves suffice. The situation is the same if we include a cosmological constant, and we're going to hear about this a little bit later today in Thomas Pawlowski's talks, or also if you include an inflationary potential with phenomenologically determined parameters. So these qualitative behaviors, the quantum bounds replacing the Big Bang singularity, is something that is common to these situations. In all cases, the quantum space-time is much larger than the classical space-time. The classical space-time corresponds just to this part of our branch, where there is a whole other branch up here, which was not there in the classical space-time. It's important to sort of emphasize that this is obtained using the matter satisfies all the energy conditions. It is a free, massless scalar field. Yet, the singularity is avoided. So one would say, well, wait a minute, but singularity theorems tell us that this cannot be. What happened up here? Well, what happened is that, as Param pointed out at the end of discussion in the last talk, what happens is that loop quantum cosmology modifies the left-hand side of Einstein's equation because of quantum geometry effects. And therefore, we don't have Einstein's equations. We have modified Einstein's equations. And that is the reason why the standard singularity theorems do not hold. You probably all also know that scalar field with some usual potentials that are used in inflation also violate various energy conditions that are used in singularity theorems. And so at first, there was a hope that inflationary potentials will actually get rid of the Big Bang singularity. But there was a theorem proved by Arvind Bordey, Alan Guth, and Alex Valenkin, which shows that even though these conditions are violated, if you have an inflationary scenario, there is always a singularity. So they did not need energy conditions. So one might say, wait a minute, they didn't need energy conditions. How does this square with that? Well, for them, by inflationary scenario, they are assuming that throughout the past history of the universe was always inflating, always was expanding. Whereas in this case, as we just saw, that's not the case. In the pre-Big Bang branch, the universe was actually contracting. Right. So therefore, that assumption is not valid, and therefore, there is that theorem is not applicable. To compare with the standard Friedmann equations, what we can do is, we can just do an algebraic manipulation. And this is possible in this very simple Friedman-Robertson-Walker models, with or without a cosmological constant, or with an inflationary potential. In this case, we can make an algebraic algebraic manipulation to basically to move the modification, which is really on the left-hand side of Einstein's equation, to the right-hand side. If you do this algebraic modification, then the Friedman equation, so to begin with, Friedman equation is really, right-hand side is just 8 pi g rho over 3, and left-hand side is not Hubble squared, but there's more quantum corrections up here. But you can move these corrections on the right-hand side, and then one gets the Friedman equation, which just looks like 8 pi g rho over 3 times 1 minus the density upon the critical density, where the critical density is about 0.41 rho Planck. Now, what happens is that when rho is equal to rho critical, this bracket vanishes, therefore A dot is equal to 0, and that is where the big bounce occurs. At the bounce point, before the bounce, A dot was negative, universe was contracting. Afterwards, it is A dot is positive, universe is expanding. At the bounce, A dot is equal to 0, and this is possible because of this minus sign. This minus sign is there just because of loop quantum gravity or quantum geometry effects. There was no freedom. It could have come with a plus sign, then the singularity would not have been resolved. In fact, in the membrane scenarios, one also gets a modification like this, but this comes with a plus sign if you have membrane with standard physical tension, and then the singularity is not resolved. Whereas here, in loop quantum gravity, it is resolved. Finally, you can construct a matter density operator at any value of scalar field. Heuristically, you can think the scalar field as an internal time parameter or an evolution parameter, and it can evolve. You can evaluate the density at a given instant of time or the evolution parameter phi, and then the formula is just the momentum of the scalar field square divided by volume squared. And this is just factor order to make itself a joint. And one can show that on the physical Hilbert space, this is important, on the physical Hilbert space, that this operator has an absolute bound. So the singularity is resolved in a very precise sense. In the theory, we have got physical or Dirac observables, namely the matter density, which are the property that in the classical theory, they grow unboundedly near the singularity, whereas in quantum theory, they remain bounded. And that is a precise sense in which the singularity is resolved. So they remain bounded, and therefore the singularity is resolved. So quantum geometry, so how does this happen? Well, what happens is basically that quantum geometry effects, they create a brand new repulsive force. And you can see this, actually, if I have more time, we can see how this repulsive force comes about in the quantum modifications of the left-hand side of Einstein's equation. So quantum geometry effects create a brand new repulsive force in the Planck regime, replacing the Big Bang by the quantum bounce. And the physics does not end at singularity. Very quickly, what happens to the closed model? If you consider k equal to 1 model, this is the Friedman-Robertson-Walker model with a passless scalar field phi, again, with k equal to 1. And these models were really studied by many, many people, particularly De Sitter, Tolman, Sakharov, and Dickey, really favored this model. I forgot to mention just a while ago that actually Gamow very much thought, he preferred this model, and he very much thought that in fact there will not be a classical Big Bang singularity, but there will be a universe, just one bounce, and there will be a universe on the other side. It's not periodic. It will just be a Big Bang universe. This actually is realized in detail in loop quantum cosmology. So there are all kinds of interesting historical tidbits here. So in this model, what happens is the following. Again, it's volume
versus scalar field. And you can think of the Verrier scalar field as an internal clock or as an evolution parameter.
As time evolves, the universe here is starting with a big bang. It expands out to a maximum volume, and classically, it undergoes a recollapse. Basically, the term, which is the matter density term, is balanced by the curvature term, k equal to 1 term, exactly here, and therefore A dot vanishes, and you get a recollapse. Start with a big bang, and you end your life in big crunch. If you looked at what happens in the Wheeler-DeWitt model,
well, again, you start your wave packet somewhere here, evolving backward and forward in time, you find that the wave packet actually does undergo a classical recollapse. Unfortunately, it evolves into big bang singularity, in the future, into the big crunch singularity.
In loop quantum gravity, we have a bounce ring or Phoenix universe. This Phoenix universe term was coined by De Sitter to talk about universe which sort of like the Phoenix, you know, is born again and again. So, again, we start up here, the wave packet. You evolve forward in time. It undergoes a recollapse. It comes up here. Classically, it would go on to a big crunch singularity. But instead, there is again a quantum bounce. Again, the deviations start when the density is about 1% of the Planck density. And the critical density up here is again about 0.41 times Planck density. And you get a bounce. And again, here also, you get a bounce. So, you get this cyclic behavior in the k equal to 1 model. There are two facts about k equal to 1 model which might be interesting. The first is that classically there is a recollapse. So one can see, one can ask if in fact is it true that the loop quantum cosmology model that we have, is it true that the loop quantum cosmology effects which are responsible for curing the Big Bang singularity, there are new quantum repulsive force, etc. here. Could it be that these force, like these new effects, actually accumulate over the history of the universe so that by the time recollapse comes, the predictions of loop quantum cosmology are quite different from those of classical theory? The effects are small, but the universe has had a huge time to evolve, so in principle it could happen that there is a deviation from classical theory. And the important thing is that this does not happen. There is no problem at all. And in fact, if you look at the classical formula, which is what is the minimum energy density at the recollapse point,
then the energy density is the minimum, the volume is
maximum.
So what is the rho minimum at the recollapse point?
Well, this is in the classical theory is given by 3 by 8 pi g times A back whole square, whereas in loop quantum gravity, there is a correction to this, the rho minimum, which is of the order of L Planck to the fourth upon A to the fourth. So this is huge. I mean, for any macroscopic universe, this is completely, completely, completely insignificant. It's really the maximum radius of the universe in the Planck units. But you could consider a universe which is sort of peculiar, which I had never thought of before we did this work. I could consider a universe which has so little matter that in fact in the classical theory,
it expands out only to 23 Planck lengths and then recollapses again.
It's really a tiny little quantum mechanical universe.
So then one can ask, what happens to such a universe? And one finds that in fact such a universe,
the agreement with the classical, with the Friedman formula is of course excellent to one part in 10 to the 5. And furthermore, the classical general relativity, even for this tiny universe, which is so counterintuitive, classical general relativity is an excellent approximation between A equal to 8 Planck length to A equal to 23 Planck length. For macroscopic universes, you know, universe which expands out to at least, say, light year or so, or million light years, then the agreement is completely, you know, is fantastic. I mean, you cannot really see it in any, there are so many powers of 10 to the minus here that you won't see it anywhere, 10 to the minus 250 or something. Okay. What about quantum bounces? This is the ultraviolet issue. So, this is the issue where we want to see when does the quantum bounce occur up here. So, here, for a universe which attains a maximum volume of 1 megaparsec cube, so this universe up here, for this universe, you can say, well, what is the minimum volume that it has? And you find that the minimum volume is not anything like a Planck length, a cube, but rather it is about 6 times 10 to the 16 centimeter cube. So it is about 10 to the 115 Planck length cube. So quantum effects can be important even when the universe is very large. I mean, many people, including me, used to think that, well, I mean, Planck's length will set the size. But in fact, what sets the size is what is the curvature. What matters is curvature. Anytime the curvature becomes Planck size, then we have got a huge quantum gravity effect. So this is a summary of the first part. Yeah. These corrections are from the, yeah. Okay, I think the good point to discuss this will be tomorrow, because most people would not understand what the context is about these higher corrections. I mean, these other corrections that you are talking about.
No.
Rho square correction, no, I don't understand. Oh, in the equations. Yeah, you're right. It's a rho square. Yeah, that's true. I thought you were talking. Yeah, it's only for the rho square connections. Right, exactly. Okay, summary up here. And I think we should have more discussions about this tomorrow after the effective equations discussion. In loop quantum gravity, the interplay between geometry and physics is elevated to the quantum mechanical level. Singularities in homogeneous classical general relativity are resolved. Quantum space tests can be vastly larger than what general relativity had us believe. And there are ramifications on some of the most interesting and fundamental issues. In k equal to 0 and k equal to 1 Friedman-Robertson-Walker models, with or without a cosmological constant, there is a complete control on the physical sector of the theory. Loop quantum cosmology evolution is deterministic across the classical Big Bang and the Big Crunch singularities for all quantum states. And the singularities are resolved because of unforeseen quantum geometry effects in the Planck regime. In the Bianchi-1 model that we'll hear about just after this talk, the bound structure is much more complicated. Roughly every time a curvature invariant or a shear term enters a Planck regime, there are deviations from classical general relativity and quantum geometry effects intervene and they dilute the particular curvature invariant we're looking at. So the curvature invariant cannot grow unboundedly, and we will see this in this talk. Challenge to the background independent theories, namely detailed recovery of classical general relativity at low curvature densities. Can this happen? So can we have two things? Can we recover general relativity at low curvature regimes and at the same time resolve singularities? The answer is yes, and this is met. This challenge is met in the homogeneous model. And as we saw from Berger and Henderson's talk this morning, the BKL conjecture suggests that is, if you use this BKL conjecture, which was discussed this morning, and use this Bianchi-1 results, there is a general suggestion that there may well be a singularity resolution theorem, namely, theorem to the effect that all space-like singularities of general relativity are resolved by quantum geometry effects. Okay, so now let me just begin with a few conceptual clarifications. The first is, why are the predictions of the Wheeler-DeWitt theory so different from those of loop quantum cosmology? We saw that generically in Wheeler-DeWitt theory, the singularities are not resolved, but in loop quantum cosmology, they are resolved. Well, since a well-defined kinematical framework did not exist in the Wheeler-DeWitt theory, to go over to quantum theory, one had to use standard quantum mechanics. Because people did not have any guidance for the full theory, so people were led to use just ordinary quantum mechanics that we are all familiar with. They took the wave function to depend on the scale factor, the scalar field, and the operators, A hat, would be multiplication operator, phi hat would be multiplication operator, and their momenta would be the derivative operators. Quantum evolution was then governed by the Wheeler-DeWitt differential equation, which is a second order differential equation, where this function f of a depends on the choice of factor ordering. And the statement is that without additional assumptions, the singularity then is not resolved in these simple models. In loop quantum cosmology, the situation is very different. Why? Because of quantum Riemannian geometry. Now, the first question that one would ask is the following. How can this be? Because quantum cosmology is just quantum mechanics. There are only finite number of degrees of freedom. And we have learned from John von Neumann that there is only one way to do quantum mechanics. There is only up to unitary equivalence. There is only one representation of the Weyl algebra or the canonical commutation relations. And we have this Hilbert space, we have got these operators. The only freedom we have is that of factor ordering, and this freedom is not sufficient to remove generic singularities. So the question is, well, what happened here? Well, what happens in loop quantum cosmology is the following. Unlike in the Wheeler-DeWitt approach, in loop quantum gravity, the quantum kinematical framework has been systematically developed. It took almost a good part of a decade to do that, more than 5 years to do that, I should say, to develop this freedom, this framework rigorously. And it culminated in a powerful uniqueness theorem due to Lewandowski, Okola, Salman, and Tiemann. And this theorem provides an arena to formulate quantum Einstein's equations. So we got unique Hilbert space on which you can formulate what the quantum Einstein's equations are. And then, of course, you have to solve those quantum Einstein's equations. Now, it turned out, so what we can do is, in loop quantum cosmology, we can mimic this unique framework step by step. And when you do that, what you find is that the Hilbert space of geometry or of gravity is not equal to the standard Hilbert space that was used in quantum mechanics or in the Wheeler-DeWitt theory, is not the space of square integral functions on the real line with respect to the Lebesgue measure and the space of connections, but rather it is a space of square integral functions on this mathematically what is called Bohr compactification of the real line with respect to a uniform measure that exists there. These two Hilbert spaces are disjoint. The only common element between these two Hilbert spaces is a zero vector. They're completely orthogonal to each other. Therefore, loop quantum cosmology, following loop quantum gravity, in loop quantum cosmology, we are led to new quantum mechanics. Not the standard kind of quantum mechanics, but kind of a new quantum mechanics. Now, in Wheeler-DeWitt theory, we did not have guidance from the full theory, and therefore people just chose this as by fiat, the obvious choice. Here we have guidance, and that leads us to a different choice. In loop quantum gravity, holonomies are well-defined, but the connections are not well-defined operators in quantum theory. So it is like if the analogy in ordinary quantum mechanics would be to say that exponentials of the position operator is well-defined, this unitary operator is well-defined, but the position operator itself is not well-defined. In other words, this unitary family of this, there is a one-parameter family of unitary operators, but it is not weakly continuous in the parameter lambda, so I cannot take the derivative with respect to lambda and define an x operator. So, in loop quantum gravity and loop quantum cosmology, holonomies are like this, they are well-defined, connections are like this, and they are not well-defined. And therefore, in von Neumann's theorem, it is assumed that these operators are weakly continuous, so we have bypassed von Neumann's theorem because one of the fundamental assumptions of von Neumann's theorem is violated as we descend from loop quantum gravity to loop quantum cosmology, systematically mimicking the procedure that is given to us by this uniqueness theorem. And now we've got new kinematics, new Hilbert space and operators, and this new kinematics cannot support the Wheeler-DeWitt dynamics. The LQC dynamics is based on quantum geometry, and the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is replaced by a difference equation. The step size in this difference equation is governed by the smallest eigenvalue of the area operator. This difference equation is a good approximation of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation at low curvatures, but there are drastic departures in the Planck regime. And this is precisely because the Wheeler-DeWitt theory ignores quantum geometry. So second question. All right. So I just told you that we don't have a differential equation. There's a difference equation. How does this come about? How is Hamiltonian constraint quantized in loop quantum cosmology? Well, the form of the Hamiltonian constraint, this is a scalar Hamiltonian constraint up here, is we got the basic canonical variable, the triad. There are two triads divided by the square root of the determinant of the metric constructed from the triad, multiplied by the field strength that is constructed from the gravitational connection. So the basic canonically conjugate variables are a gravitational connection A, and its canonically conjugate variable is a triad E. And F is constructed out of the gravitational connection A up here, whereas E is under canonically conjugate momentum. Now this operator is also non-polynomial in E, but Thomas Thiemann told us how to go about constructing its quantum analog, how to quantize the first term. The hard part is to quantize the second term. Now, what is well-defined is not the connection operator, but the holonomies operator. So the idea is to replace this field strength with holonomies. Now, in classical theory, if I want to know what the field strength is at this point, what I can do is, if I want to know its 1-2 component, so to say, what I can do is I can construct the holonomy around this square, this holonomy around the square, around this 1-2 square, AB is just the 1-2 component of the curvature, so I just take 1-2 here. Remove 1 from it, multiply it by Pauli matrices, divide by the area of this surface, and then take the limit as the area goes to 0, and that gives you FABK. So long as the connections are smooth, this is actually a well-defined formula. But in quantum theory, the problem is that this limit doesn't exist. Because, of course, if this existed, we would know that there will be a local operator corresponding to field strength, and there will be a local operator corresponding to connection. But there is no local operator corresponding to connection, and that is reflected in the fact that this limit doesn't exist. So this is completely different from full quantum gravity, and the diffeomorphism So now one can, and this is because those who know about full loop quantum gravity, there we have got diffeomorphism invariance. Here, diffeomorphism is handled by gauge fixing, and we cannot take this limit in loop quantum cosmology. So the viewpoint here is that the quantum geometry implies that we should not let the loop shrink to zero, but only till its area, the area enclosed by it, with respect to some metric, goes to the minimum eigenvalue of the area operator. But in the first go, we thought that we could just use the area evaluated using the using a fiducial metric that is constructed. For example, when you write down the Friedman-Robertson-Walker model, we write down a fiducial metric, and then we write, say, that the spatial metric is just A squared times dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared. That is the fiducial metric. So that is the fiducial metric that was used to calculate these areas. So, nonetheless, when this was done, because we did not take the limit area goes to zero, but we only shrunk it to the minimum eigenvalue of area, therefore there is a fundamental non-locality, and the familiar local expression emerges only in the classical limit. So the singularity is resolved, but the resulting quantum Hamiltonian constraint had a serious limitation. Its predictions deviated from those of the classical theory, even in the tame situations. So even in the situations, for example, if you have non-trivial cosmological constant, even when the universe was kind of large, the densities and curvature were low, this loop quantum cosmology theory deviated from classical general relativity. And this was the point that was raised by Bill Undrew and his student Nelson, that is it the case that in loop quantum cosmology, you have deviations from general relativity in tame regimes? If this is the case, then the infrared limit is not good and the theory is not acceptable. So, but it turned out, so this is a serious problem with this scheme, but it turned out that physically motivated and improved constraint remedies this drawback while retaining all the good features. So the new idea was just repeat the previous construction, but use the physical, compute the area of that loop using the physical metric, which of course depends on what state you have that you are considering. You have got the Hamiltonian constraint, it's operating on the state. The state determines the physical metric, and then we use that physical metric to compute this area. So it looks like a complicated procedure, but you think through slowly, because it took a while to understand this, think through slowly, and it makes perfect sense. You are led to a well-defined operator, and the resulting operator mimics certain features of actually the full theory, the full quantum geometry that we have in full loop quantum gravity. The idea is subtle to implement, but has important physical consequences. In particular, it overcomes all these problems that we had earlier with this Minor scheme. In particular, there is agreement with general relativity at large scales and singularity resolution. In particular, we find that the quantum big bounce occurs when the density is universal, about 0.41 times Planck density in these models where there are no gravitational waves. All we have is matter. So all those good features were preserved, but the problems were cured, and therefore this is the form of the Hamiltonian constraint that has been used in more complicated models that you will hear about in the rest of this session. And as I mentioned then, the Hamiltonian constraint, instead of being a differential equation, becomes a difference equation. This is a wave function, depends on the volume and the scalar field, and you jump steps of 4 in this volume, and these units are chosen such that this jump of from V minus 4 to V plus 4 is dictated by the smallest eigenvalue of the area operator, and this smallest eigenvalue came in because we just constructed the field strength operator by shrinking the loop to the smallest eigenvalue. This lattice, this difference equation, this lattice has uniform spacing in volume, but not in, those of you know, not in A squared or P or mu. And those of you also know, Velino had proposed that we could construct quantum kinematics in a different way. Well, Velino's theory cannot support this dynamics that is up here. So we really have to construct quantum kinematics as was done before. Just a one small remark, and then I'll just go to the last point. The small remark is just the following. In the older papers, many of you will find that the critical density that we write down is typically rho critical to be equal to 0.82 rho Planck. Whereas in the newer papers, and in this talk, I have 0.41, so there is a factor of 2 difference up here. Where does this factor of 2 difference come from? Well, as we saw, what was really critical in all this thing is to shrink the areas to its minimum eigenvalue. The question is, what do you mean by minimum eigenvalue? So in the older literature, we just, without thinking too hard, we just chose the absolute minimum of the non-zero value in the spectrum of the area operator. But that corresponds to having a surface up here whose area we are calculating, and having an edge, one which is tangential, and one edge is tangential and one of our edges transversal up here. As we'll see in a talk that will come about in a few minutes, if we want to think about loop quantum cosmological geometries arising from loop quantum gravity, then you don't want edges like that. You want edges which are just transversal to all the surfaces. If you have a cell, you should have edges going this way, and this way. And not, so for at each surface, they'll be intersecting in a transversal way this way. And it turns out that the area associated with such transversal edges is, the minimum area is twice that associated with here, and that is why 0.82 has been now replaced by 0.41. And this seems to be physically more close to what would happen in loop quantum gravity, as we would hear, I think, in Ed Stock. Okay, so now let me just go to the last point. And the last point is just the following. I mean, for good reasons, many people say that, well, okay, there are all these very nice results in loop quantum cosmology. Maybe even using anisotropies, maybe using inflationary potentials. But after all, It really has only a finite number of degrees of freedom. Maybe you can extend it, as we'll hear tomorrow, using in Guillermo's talk. We can try to look at Gaudi models, which have infinitely many degrees of freedom, but treat them up using quantum geometry. And even then, the singularity has to be resolved, as we'll see tomorrow up here. So one might still ask that this is not full quantum gravity. You still have symmetries imposed, you have symmetry reductions and so on. So isn't this a tie model, and why should we be interested in it? I can think of three reasons, really. The first is, think of hydrogen atom. And supposing in a hypothetical universe, somebody had actually discovered quantum electrodynamics, had full quantum gravity theory, but somehow Dirac had not really solved the hydrogen atom using the standard methods that we use to solve the Dirac equation. And then Dirac comes along and says, look, I can solve this hydrogen atom. Forget about photon fields. Forget about radiative degrees of freedom. Assume just spherical symmetry that kills all the photons. And solve this equation, and I get hydrogen atom, and I get this nice spectrum, and isn't this nice? Well, anybody doing quantum electrodynamics would immediately say, wait a minute, it's such a toy model. I mean, why are you believing in this? Right? Because you have ignored all photon degrees of freedom, all the radiative degrees of freedom. So our answer is that, well, I mean, it turns out that this is highly successful. In fact, we do not know how to do hydrogen atom in full quantum electrodynamics today. I mean, because the bound state is a very hard problem. But Dirac gives us a very good approximation to what happens. So similarly, loop quantum cosmology might serve a similar purpose. The second thing is that, recall that the singularity theorems were discovered in classical general relativity first in the simplest models, which had lots of symmetries. Friedman-Robertson-Walker model, Schwarzschild space-time, etc. But then slowly, one realizes that those singularities are not special cases, but they are in fact much more general. So could it be that in fact our finding in simple models that quantum geometry effects can resolve singularities is really the tip of the iceberg, and in fact there is a general singularity resolution theorems. In fact, as we will see, classically we know that the inhomogeneities can be treated as perturbations. So one could do quantum field theory on quantum geometries that is provided by loop quantum cosmology of homogeneous models, and then see what happens. And this would be a very rich way of understanding or of supplementing ordinary quantum field theory in curved space times that one uses in cosmology, incorporating quantum geometry effects. And also, perhaps one could use Fock quantization, as in Maynard's talk tomorrow, in a hybrid approach, where some degrees of freedom, which really, like the Bianchi degrees of freedom that Beverly referred to this morning, are actually quantized using loop techniques. So that gives us a quantum geometry, and the other degrees of freedom could be quantized using Fock space, and that gives us this like treating matter. And in this hybrid approach, again, one can explore what is going on. So loop quantum cosmology is of interest for many reasons. It's a fertile ground to go into more realistic and more physical situations. Of course, this does not imply that the behavior found in examples is really generic, but rather I think our viewpoint is that they reveal important aspects of the full theory. One can work one's way up by considering more and more complicated cases. At each step, there are physical steps which go well beyond formal mathematics, and they provide strong lessons for full theory. For example, we already saw this mu naught and mu bar quantization of the Hamiltonian constraint. So where loop quantum cosmology has taught us that loopy techniques do capture sectors with good semi-classical behavior, but they do that only if the Hamiltonian constraint is quantized in a careful way. There are many subtleties, and these subtleties will have to be incorporated also in the full theory. Thank you.
So generic system, taking BKL literally. So, in order to save yourself some work, solve a bunch of that are mixed master models, and you have some smooth variation of the key parameter and initial data. And so they start out sort of smoothly in step, and then you get bounces at different places at different times and you proceed. And then quantum geometry comes in. Presumably at different times, at different places, and everything gets tangled up. And when it all expands again, is there any intuition on whether it should sort of untangle and start out smooth again?
Right. So I think what would happen is that if you start with this and you evolve, then again, until the shear terms, locally computed shear terms, enter the Planck regime, the Einstein evolution would be mimicked here. Now, however, locally, because even though they are smoothly varying, maybe as time goes on, you know, some things evolve faster, and therefore, someplace the shear or the curvature term enters the Planck regime earlier than the other one. Then here, as you say, in those places, the quantum geometry effect, the repulsive force and comes into picture and dilutes the shear term. But one of the things that I did not have time to go into is the following, that this quantum geometry effect has these two features which I had never believed, you know, thought or even imagined before. One is that they're so strong that they overcome all of classical attraction, I mean, in one time. The second is that they're extremely short-lived. I mean, of course, it is always there, but its strength, the repulsive force there, strength, dies away completely once, if it is density, once the density is about 1% of the Planck density. So, roughly, every time this curvature invariant reaches 1% of the Planck value, then again, classical relativity takes over. So, there will be little patches here, there, any time this curvature scalar approaches this particular value, any of the curvature scalars approaches this value, there will be a deviation that will dilute this curvature, and in that region, the classical general relativity is a very bad approximation, but as soon as it is diluted, it's again going to be perfectly, you know, it's again going to be smooth up here. The simulations some of the results that Kevin has, that we might see in Edge talk up here, they indicate that these simulations are only the Gauri models, are only in the Bianchi-1 models, right? So there, these bounces occur rather close to each other. They are distinct bounces, but they occur rather close to each other. Of course, in the generic thing, they might occur quite far from each other, but many of them would actually occur some close to each other. So there will be some region where Einstein's equations are badly violated. In fact, it will also be generally the case that there will be regions in which the classical metric is fluctuating so rapidly that there is no classical geometry that I can really talk about. But very soon, it will again be classical. So the short answer to your question is yes. I do expect there will be some regime in which there will be bubbles of funny things happening all over the place. But then after that, since the curvatures are all diluting again, then the classical general relativity again would be a good approximation. So, we don't really need a scalar field, we don't really need a notion of time in the whole game, right? There is a very general prescription. Let me start from scratch. Okay. Supposing you consider, supposing you give me some general matter field or such thing, and there is no zero Riemann scalar field or something, and I don't want to select any of them as defining time. So in quantum theory, what you have is just a constraint, right? And some operator operating the wave function is equal to zero. That is a constraint. The solutions to this constraint are the physical states. And then the physical Hilbert space, oh, that's good. So physical Hilbert space is constructed from the space of these solutions to the constraint. Okay? So we got a constraint which says that C hat operating on psi is equal to zero, and these are the physical states. And then what you want to do is to evaluate a scalar product in the product here. And there is a very general procedure called group averaging. Which will lead you to, there are some technical steps, but I mean that procedure will lead you to a physical Hilbert space. So that will tell you how to evaluate the products up here. And then you'll have to look for suitable observables on this Hilbert space and go on. So we don't really need to isolate anything as time. But if you do have a scalar field, big simplification occurs. And the simplification is that the scalar constraint can be written as I d phi operating on psi is equal to some operator theta. Technical reasons, let me use the standard terminology. It's the square root of some other operator. Square root of theta operating on psi. Okay. Now, if you have such a form of the metric up here, as such a form of the constraint, you can forget about this form of the constraint. You can just apply this procedure and you will get a group averaging and it will give you the answer. But we don't have good physical intuition for this group averaging. Most of us don't have. But on the other hand, this equation looks very much like actually the equation that you do get first of all for physical states. I took the square root of this equation. It just looks like d2 phi is equal to minus theta of psi, where theta is some difference operator. And this operator is, in simple cases, is even independent of theta. So this looks very much like the Klein-Gordon equation. D2 by dt square of psi is equal to Laplacian times psi. This is a difference operator, which is like the analog of the Laplacian. And if it really looks like exactly like the Klein-Gordon equation in static space-time. And so if I think of phi as being time, this looks like the Klein-Gordon equation. And then I can just repeat the procedure that I know from textbook to construct the Hilbert space. That Hilbert space is exactly the same as this Hilbert space. But now in this case, if I think of this time, I mean, I have much more intuition. For example, I can say, well, I want to construct an operator which corresponds to density evaluated at some instant of time, phi equal to phi naught. So it gives us much more ammunition. It makes physics much more tractable, extract physics. So it's not as absolutely essential that any one of them is called as time. But it makes it easier to extract physics if one of the variables is identified as time. Yeah. So if you can start with this approach, then of course if you're clever, you would be able to notice that this actually is a well-defined operator here on this Dirac Hilbert space. But it may not be transparent to you. Right, you might need some matter fields, or it could be curvature at a given, matter and curvature is the two things together that you would have to use in order to construct the physical observables there. There are general theorems which tell you, if you are an operator on the kinematical Hilbert space, which has some property, then they will descend down and become physical operators. So you could use those theorems. I mean, sometimes people use those theorems. But it's a struggle. Whereas in this case, you can construct operators for which you have direct physical meaning. So what we have is really, we have got V and phi, or density and phi, maybe, or V and phi, as coordinates. I mean, you can use either of them as coordinates. And the wave function depends on both of them. And then we can, if we heuristically think, The physical state is just a solution of this equation at the end of it. But if you heuristically think that it is evolving with respect to phi, then I can make contact with ordinary cosmology also. I got a space-time picture. If I just do this, I do not have a direct space-time picture. That is another problem. To connect it with the standard cosmology is much harder in this case. You mean not semi-classical states?
Yep.
Okay, good. So if you start with a non-semi-classical state, so first of all, this result of singularity resolution is completely generic in the sense that
May I have it here?
Back in this room. Don't do it until, yeah. Thank you. Please. So in this solvable case where k equal to 0, lambda equal to 0 case, one can construct any state whatsoever, psi, and you can take the expectation value of the volume operator on any state. This is the physical expectation value. And what one finds is that, in fact, this is given by v plus times an exponential of phi and v minus times the exponential of minus phi, where v plus v minus are determined completely by the initial data. You give me a state at any instant of time that you want, I can construct this v plus v minus for you. And so from here, immediately it follows that as phi goes to infinity, this term is going to dominate, this does not, so I get infinity. As phi goes to minus infinity, this term dominates, this does not, and I again get volume to be infinity. So there really is a minimum volume, and the minimum volume, of course, depends on the state about this, what v plus minus are. Depends on the initial data of the state up here. And you can also find at what time does the bounce occur, and that also depends on just this v plus minus. So given any state, you have got this quantitative feature. And the other result that I just mentioned, which might be here, So basically, there is an analytical way to understand this critical density. So what we can do is we can construct this density operator that I just mentioned. This is the square of the momentum of the scalar field divided by volume squared, and I have just distributed it symmetrically. And then one can just look at the physical Hilbert space, and then it turns out that this physical, on the physical Hilbert space, there is an upper bound to the eigenvalue or the spectrum of this operator, and there's an analytical formula for it. And if you substitute the values of gamma, which come from Blackwell entropy calculation, then this turns out to be precisely 0.41 times rho Planck squared, rho Planck. So this also is something that is a result on the full physical Hilbert space. It doesn't depend on some classical space or something or anything like that. But if you looked at Gaussians, Gaussians at late times, which are semi-classical, then one finds that, in fact, the density of in such a state at the bounce point approaches this value to a very good approximation. Okay. So there are general results that are known for any state, like the singularity resolution results, and particularly the boundedness of the rho result. That is completely for any state. Since I have this formula here, I just wanted to point out one other thing, which is that, remember, look at this rho, that depends on the cubic power of this Barberi immersive parameter. The value of this parameter is about 0.24, 0.2375, etc. And that is what is used in this calculations up here. But if this value were off by a factor of 10, then the upper bound here would be off by a factor of 1,000. So it's quite sensitive to that. So there's a nice kind of convergence of ideas up here coming from, you know, loop quantum cosmology and black hole, loop quantum gravity and black hole entropy, etc. Of course, it's not a proof of anything, but it's nice to see that things are actually coming together. No, not, okay, good. So, first of all, there's nothing that is wrong. I mean, we just have additional representations mathematically. But what is distinct about this? What is distinct about this is the Hilbert space that you get in this case is not separable. This means that you do not have countable basis in the Hilbert space. So at first, when we realized this in the 80s, a long time ago, that this is going to be a problem. I mean, we did not have quantum cosmology, but I was trying to see what we are doing in loop quantum gravity and mimicking it in systems with finite number of degrees of freedom. And I was very worried that that meant that we would not have, you know, we would not be able to do any mathematics. We had to reinvent everything. But it turns out that there's a very nice book by Rudin, just functional analysis. Maybe that you have to look at the older edition. I'm not sure about this. Which does all the spectral theory without the separability assumption. So all the Hilbert space theory we know with self-adjoint operators, the spectra, etc., etc., all goes through in the case then the Hilbert space is non-separable. And so there are no problems about exponentiating self-adjoint operators, so then unitary operators, etc., etc. Finally, even though the kinematical Hilbert space, which is what resulted from the Weyl algebra, is not separable, by the time you solve the Hamiltonian constraint and so on, because there are superselection sectors that I mentioned to you yesterday, because of that, the physical Hilbert space is actually separable. So, if you want to work in the physical Hilbert space, there is no problem at all. Since I have this transparency, I'll just take one more minute to make one remark. Oh, okay, we can stop.
No,
that's, we have time.
Okay. One more remark about this
row. You see, this is only for those of you who already know a few things. Rho has inverse volume operator up here. Now, if you use this Tiemann trick to define the inverse volume operator, then it turns out that the inverse volume operator is also bounded. You know, it does not have, in other words, classically, inverse volume would go to become infinite when V equal to 0. But this operator, the way that it is defined by Tiemann, is a self-adjoint operator, and that operator actually is bounded. It doesn't become infinity anywhere. But since that operator is bounded, one is tempted to say, well, but I already know. This is bounded. Classically, the reason why density becomes infinity is because density is given by P phi squared upon 2V squared. V goes to 0. P phi is the constant of motion in this theory because there is no potential. The scalar field is massless. So therefore, it would look like classically, this becomes infinite because V goes to 0 near the singularity. If 1 upon V is bounded, then one would say, I know that rho is bounded, it's no problem. So already at the kinematical level, I used to think that maybe there is no problem. But I was never happy with this because it is bounded provided you fix the value of P phi. Right? P phi is not a bounded operator. P phi can take any value it wants. So the operator of the full Hilbert space is still unbounded. It's just that P phi is a constant of motion, so I can just look at a subspace in which P phi is less than some given value, then the density operator is bounded. So what I'm trying to say is that at the purely kinematical level, the density operator can be bounded because of the Tiemann effect, but only on subspaces where P phi is less than a given value. If you want to allow all possible P phi values, right, then this operator is unbounded. And to me, it was a very pleasant surprise that on the physical Hilbert space, this result is only true on the physical Hilbert space. On the physical Hilbert space, this as a whole is bounded. Okay? So that's a key point. This whole operator is bounded on the physical Hilbert space, which is, I mean, I'm not restricting P phi to be anything. This operator as a whole is bounded. So that's why it's a very non-trivial statement, which goes much beyond the kinematical facts associated with the Tiemann construction.
First one will be by Edward Wilson Ewing.